You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people, the places, and the petrol of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. So far this summer, the Southland has gotten off easy when it comes to wildfires, knock wood. But when something does eventually spark, one of the places that'll be helping in the fight to put it out is the Santa Maria Airport. This outpost north of Santa Barbara has a big asset.
We are the largest runway between San Jose and LAX for civilian airports.
Chris Kunkel sports a Hawaiian shirt and mullet. Yeah, a mullet. As he shows off this 8,000-foot runway. It allows Santa Maria to be one of a handful of bases in the state that can host the biggest firefighting aircraft. Kunkel is VP of Operations at the Central Coast Jet Center. It's what's known as a fixed base operator. They provide services to the private planes that pass through, including the fire jets.
These tanker bases hold a very crucial part in fighting fires. I don't think there's one thing that anybody can say puts a fire out, but the air assets are a huge help.
One of the services Kunkel's business provides the big tankers is fuel. And lately, he says, getting the fuel the planes need has gotten a lot harder. If the Jet Center's storage tanks ran dry during an emergency, he says the worst-case scenario would be
not being able to fly aircraft and burning property and forest land and, you know, potentially hurting people. I hope it doesn't get to that.
Yeah, we hope not either. So why is it hard to get jet fuel? And what does it mean for firefighting efforts here as we stare down the hottest and most dangerous months of the year? Here's KCRW's Matt Gillum.
It's a pretty simple formula. If the fire planes can't get the fuel they need, they can't fly. If they have to go to a base further out to fuel up, that means longer times between retardant or water drops. Imagine this. Multiple wildfires are burning in Southern California. The big tanker jets have been called in, and some are flying out of the base in San Bernardino, while others use Santa Maria to load up on fuel and retardant. Suddenly, Santa Maria's gas tanks run dry. Unless the Inland Empire has fuel to spare or can conjure more, both unlikely, the planes using Santa Maria might have to go all the way up to Sacramento for fuel before flying back down the state to make a drop on the fire. If that sounds bad, a version of this is already playing out.
This morning is a perfect example. We got a call from our chief pilot. They are up in Helena, Montana, and they just got dispatched to a fire, and their estimate is they're going to be able to pull one more load out of Helena, and then they're going to be completely dry. They'll be out of fuel up there, so they're going to have to relocate down to Pocatello, Idaho, or maybe over to Medford, Oregon.
Meet Ryan Curl, a tanker pilot who flies a former DC-10 passenger jet that's been converted to one of the largest firefighting aircraft out there. The company he works for, 10 Tanker, sends their small fleet of big planes all over the world to fight fires. On this day, Curl's jet is here in Santa Maria, but at a moment's notice, they could be sent to a fire anywhere. He says shades of that fuel shortage his buddies in Montana dealt with have shown up at this tanker base near the California coast.
For them to say that there is now a problem, you know, it's related solely to the supply line as opposed to the storage, then that, you know, for us, that is a pretty big deal.
Did you catch that? He said supply line. Santa Maria has plenty of fuel storage capacity. They have a pair of 20,000-gallon storage tanks, actually. But Curl said the problem is with the supply. Chris Kunkel, the man with the mullet who oversees operations here, says an early season fire in June brought the fuel issue into sharp focus for Santa Maria. They burned through half their supply in a day, but could only get one truckload, not nearly enough, to try and resupply. What'd they do?
The fire lasted 2 days, and we were able to restock all the tanks. Early fires in California don't tend to go more than a couple of days just because the fuels aren't ready. So we got we'll call it luck.
Typically, words like ready or prepared are what you want to hear when describing the efforts to put out a fire. I'm not offering any complaints about luck, but it doesn't exactly lend itself to tons of confidence. It's not unheard of that more rural airports that double as tanker bases experience fueling issues when the big jets come roaring in. But our DC-10 pilot, Ryan Curl, says something is different in 2021.
So I think a lot of what we've seen in the past had more to do with just the fact that we often run out of smaller airports that don't have the storage capacity, but now it's become a supply issue.
Well, if it's a supply issue, let's talk to the guy who supplies the Central Coast Jet Center with their fuel. Grab your 10-gallon hat and tip it to Texas oilman Mark Haynes.
Well, I always laugh at people say, where are you from? I say New York City. It doesn't get me too far down the road with them.
He's a vice president of sales with AvFuel, They're one of the biggest suppliers to fixed base operators like the Jet Center nationwide. He's been in the industry for 38 years, and in all that time,
I've never seen it like this. As far as just looking at a big area and just how much demand is out there for fuel and the lack of trucking and the lack of supply, we've never encountered this before.
2021 is presenting two problems per the Texan, a lack of trucks and a general supply issue. Refineries in SoCal are chugging along, so we've got the fuel. The big problem here and across the West is trucking. Haynes says a driver shortage is hobbling fuel mobility.
Usually, like if Santa Maria would call and say, I need 8 loads tomorrow because they've got the fire going on, we usually do pretty good of getting them 8. Now we're struggling to say, Chris, we're going to be in 4 to 5 loads. There's only so much that we can move around to make that happen.
Limited number of drivers, limited speed of moving fuel. Although we're suddenly feeling the crunch now, Haynes says the trucker trouble has been something of a slow-moving catastrophe.
This has not just been coming on overnight, okay? This was happening in 17 and 18 and 19. Just 20 took all the wind out of the industry. And now it's just a flat rebuild of trying to get these people back and working. I just don't see that this is going to get resolved in 2021.
So Haynes doesn't see a quick fix for the trucking issue. But why are we here in the first place? Enter Chris Hasty, the president and co-owner of JetSpeed, a trucking company based in Long Beach that exclusively hauls jet fuel. Hasty compares the current squeeze to another commodity. White gold, anyone?
It's kind of like the toilet paper. Everybody had to have it. And that's what's happening too now. Now you can't get a load of jet fuel. So what are the airports doing? They're filling their tanks to the brim, ordering.
All that buying, or if we're keeping the teepee thing going, hoarding, could be too much of a good thing for Hasty.
I can't do half the loads that were being requested for at this point.
He says he can't keep up because, like so many other sectors right now, restaurants, retail, you name it, finding people to do the job has become a Herculean task. Competition in this space is fierce. At JetSpeed, the workday can stretch to 14 hours. However, a trucker can make up to $35 an hour. But Hasty says in the world of fuel hauling, driving around a load of jet fuel actually isn't as sexy as driving around your standard gasoline.
I can't attract them because they're all getting pulled over there for up to $40 an hour to go haul gas. They're doing $5,000 sign-on bonuses.
Even if he could wave a magic wand and have enough drivers to keep his fleet of 14 rigs rolling, the supply issue extends beyond qualified people.
You couldn't get a truck now or a trailer if you wanted to, probably a year, because the economy is like booming. Gas companies, or the gas haulers, I should say, are busy.
To recap, it's hard to find drivers and trucks are on back order. Let's throw in one more complication. Hasty has regular clients who engage him to deliver fuel. If a fire sparks, yeah, sure, he may want to run a load to the planes or helicopters working on putting it out, but those regular orders still need to be filled.
It's hard for me to screw over my regular customers just to go do this fire. And I feel bad. Don't get me wrong. I do feel bad that I can't help out, but I only have a certain amount of trucks and a certain amount of drivers.
It's back to the Central Coast Jet Center in Santa Maria, where there's mounting unease about the fuel situation. It got by earlier in the season because just one big fire plane came to put out a blaze that didn't last long. But with fuel disruptions already causing aircraft to reroute in the Mountain West, Ryan Curl, the 10-tanker jet pilot who flies in and out of all these bases, says he expects the problem will migrate.
We plan on it now. The later part, August, September, October, is when the Southern California wildfire season really takes off. You know, we're feeling the crunch up north right now, and it's inevitable that, you know, the operation's going to move south, and I don't see any reason for it to change.
No matter what, officials will find a way to get the planes in the air and over the fires. It just might be a bit longer between drops. While bases like Santa Maria may be as ready and prepared as they can be, a little luck probably wouldn't hurt. For KCRW, I'm Matt Gillum.
Coming up, there's been a lot of attention given to the idea of universal basic income. Now LA County is giving money to a group of young people coming out of the foster care system. What's the idea behind it? And should it be more than just money? That's yours on the other side of this.
Yeah. Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
It's Greater LA on KCRW. Steve Chiotakis here. Last month, the Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors unanimously approved a Universal Basic Income, or UBI, plan to provide $1,200 a month to 150 young adults ages 18 to 24 who are already receiving general relief benefits. The checks aim to help those most at risk, including youth who are transitioning out of the foster care system. Well, cities like Stockton, Long Beach, Oakland, they've started their own UBI pilot programs, handing out monthly checks to low-income residents. But L.A. County is getting even more specific. And joining us now to talk about it are a couple of folks who have personal experience with the foster care system. Jackie Robles recently aged out of it and sits on L.A. County's Youth Commission. Hey, Jackie.
Hi.
And Tiffany Boyd also is an emancipated foster youth who sits on the L.A. County Commission for Children and Families. Tiffany, welcome to you.
Hi, thank you. We're happy to be here.
All right. Well, I'm going to start with you, because as someone who has advocated for foster youth for such a long time, and having been in the system yourself, who's the program aiming to help?
I think those who can't seek help elsewhere would be the primary goal with this. You know, oftentimes we fold back to family in times of crisis and in times of need. And within this population, there's a fractured family structure oftentimes. And that help and that assistance to be able to go back and say, hey, mom, hey, dad, I just need a gap filler, or I need to get through this crisis and pandemic, or I'm just trying to get through the semester, or I'm behind on rent, whatever some of those issues are. The unfortunate side of coming through the system is that you are, through that process, disconnected with your family oftentimes and those resources that would come with that. And in fact, I lived in what we'll call, for the purpose of this, an unofficial pilot program. Right before emancipating, was placed in my sister's custody, a sister who made it a point to make sure that I knew that she did not want me for the check. So I was a senior in high school with a sister who would get a check every month for me in my custody, and she would literally cash the check and hand over that money for me. I had guaranteed income, so to speak, in high school. I used that money to be able to build out a small business for myself, to be able to have my prom things and everything that I needed and not have to depend so much on the system. But then upon emancipating, only thing, and once that check stopped, at my age and at that time, the only thing that the county had for me was a transitional housing program. If I could have breathed just a little bit more instead of having to be so focused, I think some of the decisions that I'm making later on in life might have come to fruition a bit sooner for me, having not had to go through so many hurdles and have so many financial difficulties to go through.
Jackie, you're 22. You're at that prime age, right? You've exited, been emancipated from the foster program, from foster care. What are the biggest struggles that you're encountering right now as it pertains to your finances? Do you hear what Tiffany is saying, and does it resonate with you too?
Yeah, I mean, this is just such a critical time, especially now that the pandemic has added like an extra layer to these challenges that foster youth face. Especially for me, speaking from my own personal experience, I emancipated last year, right during the pandemic, and I was turning 21 and I was graduating college, and I too was in a transitional housing program. But after I turned 21, I actually was almost just kicked out and my funding stopped at that time. And I was on my way to graduate and I was facing homelessness. So a guaranteed income definitely allows you to relieve that financial burden that foster youth often face with lack of family support that my peers may have that I wouldn't have.
Tiffany, I assume there are way more than 150 young adults who are eligible for these checks, right? Do you know what the selection process will look like?
So at this time, I believe that a lot of the details and the kinks of it all are being worked out. The initial motion is in collaboration and connection with the GR program. And I know that General Relief had an initial idea of what they wanted to do as far as a guaranteed income. And this is more so allowing them to focus on the population within the population. And instead of looking at TAE as just the age of 18 to 24, this motion is allowing us to take a look at the most vulnerable within the TAE population.
What does TAE stand for? It's T-A-Y?
Yeah, T-A-Y, Transition Age Youth. So, for example, when we say TAE in the DCFS world or the child welfare world, we're also saying 18 to 24, but we're specifically referring to system impacted young people. Whereas DPSS or GR, when they refer to TAE, they're going by just strictly age alone, 18 to 24.
Jackie, if you get selected, if you're one of the 150 lucky ones, what are you going to do with the money?
Well, I am... Right now, I'm in my master's program, so with that, I'm not able to work as much as I would want to. So if I got that money, it would definitely be going to my rent and some of my bills so I can focus on school.
What do you think it's going to take, Jackie, for a program like this to be successful? I mean, what kind of support do you need? You mentioned rent. You mentioned, you know, you're in your master's program. I mean, what do you need beyond the money? I mean, financial literacy. Do you need to know how to make money, to sustain money, to save it so you can retire later in life? I mean, those are a lot of lessons that young people don't get, right?
Yeah, I think personally for our population, I think providing some kind of financial literacy so these people that do get chosen don't just take their, you know, $1,200 and go spend it on, I don't know, In-N-Out. And so they can use it on what they need most and what's going to help them. For example, I mentioned, you know, if I can pay my rent and my bills, I can focus on school right now, but I'm not going to go take that money and go spend it on In-N-Out. But I know that may not be the case for everyone that may get selected.
What do you say to the critics, Tiffany, who are like, we don't have the money for this? I mean, this is money that we're needing to invest in other things, in infrastructure and police and fire protection and things that the county really needs to do. What do you say to those critics?
I would say I agree, but I also would encourage them to look at the budget and look at where these young people end up otherwise. Look at how much the cost to DPSS or Social Security or incarceration. I highly doubt that $1,000 a month would equate to the same amount. And as it's spelled out right now, it would be foster youth and single mothers that are 18 to 24 years old. Those are two of the most vulnerable populations that we have among us. So yes, do we have emergencies? Do we have things that we need to focus on? But I think taking responsibility for the populations that we as a society have created, to step into someone's home and say, hey, the way you're raising your child is not up to par. We're going to put them into a system and we're going to do a better job. The system took a sense of responsibility for those young people that I don't think should cut off at 18 or 21.
Well, thank you so much to both of you for coming on and telling the story and giving us an update on what's going on over there. Tiffany Boyd, who sits on the L.A. County Commission for Children and Families. Jackie Robles, who sits on the L.A. County Youth Commission. Much appreciated, you two. Thank you so much.
Of course. Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. And before you leave us, a word about how meals on many California tables could soon change. Proposition 12 easily passed here in 2018 by 25 points. The farm animal confinement proposition requires farmers to upgrade the size of their spaces for animals that they raise for food, and it bans the sale of products from any farm inside or outside of California that doesn't meet those new standards. Well, come next year, the state will begin enforcing Proposition 12, which is good news for the animals, but maybe not so much if you love to eat pork products like ham or bacon. If out-of-state producers comply, then prices will likely go up all around the country. If they don't, prices will probably go up here in California, and there could even be shortages. Ed Kilgore is a Democratic strategist and columnist at New York Magazine. He penned an editorial about this potential pork upheaval this week. Hey, Ed.
Hey, good to talk to you.
What are these new rules that are going into effect, and why are they causing such a stir among farmers?
Well, they specify minimum area in storage facilities, you know, based on some pretty terrifying publicity about the terrible lives they lead, not even able to turn around in their cages in many cases.
Yeah.
And it's something that's been kicking around in California and other states for a while. The Humane Society is the big proponent of this ballot initiative and this law. And whereas egg producers and beef producers, who are also the targets of this initiative, seem likely to comply when it's fully implemented, the pork producers have been fighting this in federal courts here on the West Coast and in Iowa. Doesn't look like they're going to win, but it also doesn't look like they're going to be able to comply, or they say they won't, even though they understand that they'll be losing a huge market in California, which represents about 15% of the national market for pork.
I mean, so if you do eat pork, you eat bacon or ham, should you be more worried that it's going to disappear off the shelves, it's going to become more expensive? I mean, there's a lot of hyperbole out there, Ed.
Yeah, and of course, you know, for a lot of us, it's not something we want to think very deeply about, how animals are treated who are raised for meat. I voted for this initiative. I love bacon. I love pork products. I want the piggies to be treated better. But now I find myself, when I hear about the potential shortage, wondering if I need to race to my closest wholesale distributor and buy up their wonderful pre-cooked bacon before the holidays. So, you know, it's doing actually what the initiative was really intended to do on a broader scale, which is to make people think a little bit more about their choices of food, particularly now with non-meat alternatives becoming available, albeit at least with bacon, not necessarily the tastiest alternatives.
Is there a chance, Ed, that this will be amended somehow? Like you said, the pork industry took it to court and is not winning. Can someone intervene, or is this just the way it's going to be, and, you know, there's going to be a shortage of bacon?
I think, to use probably an inadvisable animal analogy, I think both sides are playing a little chicken. As you suggested, there's some fears that the threat of a supply disruption or skyrocketing prices may be a little disingenuous. Basically, the pork industry doesn't want to have to change its ways. It's a political issue in Iowa, by the way, as you might imagine, as much as it is in California. You know, the legal argument that California is trying to sort of impose its rules on other states in violation of interstate commerce is the one that the producers have been pursuing so avidly, but so far they've struck out in federal court and appear likely to continue to do so. Yeah, there's some talk of an amendment, but, I mean, it's a ballot initiative-imposed law, so it gets a little tricky to monkey with it in the legislature. That's a possibility, but I think it's unlikely. I think we're going to see some expensive bacon and possibly a supply disruption, or, you know, these threats could turn out to be a little disingenuous. We'll just have to see.
I mean, California often is the sort of the scapegoat, right, across the country.
There's a little good-natured ribbing that goes back and forth between all other states and California because of our size. And then I think it's generally accepted that usually it's California that takes the lead in progressive directions. So, you know, it's a pinata you can whack from a lot of different directions.
I mean, it's a big win for animal rights activists for sure. What do they have to say about the huge backlash coming from pork farmers?
Most animal rights activists believe that the industry has to be forced to change by public opinion, by law. You know, the other wrinkle in this is one of the opponents of Prop 12 was actually PETA, which takes the position that any sort of efforts to regulate meat for consumption misses the whole point that we need to stop doing this altogether.
Yeah.
So even animal welfare proponents are a little bit split on this, and obviously, the pork producers will take advantage of that, too.
Well, something that we're obviously watching in the coming months, Ed Kilgore, political columnist over at New York Magazine and former Democratic strategist. Ed, thanks.
You are welcome.
A That's our episode for today. Next week, as the Olympics wrap up in Tokyo this weekend, a lot of folks in LA are paying close attention to the harsh realities of hosting the Games, especially in the middle of a pandemic and 1 year late. With LA hosting in 2028, how's that going over with a host of problems here? And among all those street vendors you see selling tacos and churros and bacon-wrapped hot dogs, oh, that sounds so good, only a small fraction have official permits. Why? All yours next week on GLA. Catherine Barnes, Jackie Sedley, Jenna Cagle, Ray Guarna, Sue Margulies, Phil Richards, Mario Saavedra, Amy Ta, Christine Comito, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordahl were all instrumental on this evening's show. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Have yourself a great night.